So there's a writer named Rob Copeland, who's the author of a book, The Fund, Ray Dalio, Bridgewater Associates, and the Unraveling of a Wall Street Legend. It sold well, and it scored a bunch of good reviews. And on Twitter the other day, a reader complimented Copeland on his work, while noting that he took The Fund out from his local library. And Copeland tweeted back, "It's even better when you buy, not borrow, your copy." He was slammed for his words, and he fucking deserved it. I know we do this in part to make money and to eat and survive, but being read is an honor. And whether someone buys your book, or checks it out from the Mailpack Public Library, or finds it submerged in a puddle, if they're taking the time to absorb it, we should be grateful, whether we're getting a buck off of it or not. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Justin Sales, an editor and writer for The Ringer, and the creator and host of my favorite podcast series of the year, The Wedding Scam. This is episode number 358. Let's sing some yay.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you smell like Jack Sigma's armpit.
All right, Justin. So, I'm a couple weeks ago, I'm driving from Oakland to Orange County, which is a very long drive. And I put out on Twitter, I need a podcast to listen to. And tons of people write back. But the first person to respond says, there's a show called The Wedding Scammer. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, all right, I guess I'll put it on. Hadn't heard of it. Just haven't been in tune to podcasts lately. And I start listening outside of Oakland. And by the time I get back to my home in Orange County, I'm just absorbed. I'm literally sitting in the car, not leaving the car, listening to your podcast. I thought it was that good. I thought it was that engrossing. This is going to be a weird question.
Okay.
That I've never asked someone who's done a podcast. Do you find it that good and that engrossing, or do you see the flaws and warts in your work?
Okay. First of all, thank you. Hearing that you say that is just absolutely amazing. So I'm bad at receiving compliments, but I do have to acknowledge that before I go on. We put a lot of work into this and I'm very proud of what we did. There are certain things that I would have loved to have done differently, both in the reporting, both in the, like, there were certain storytelling things I thought about after the fact that would have been like, we should have done that. There were things that we couldn't include for whether it was just like the lawyers were like, we don't feel very good about including this, or, you know, a couple producers work on the show. They weren't as enamored with some of the details as I was. So some of those things end up on the cutting room floor. But I am very proud of what we do. I don't really know how to answer the question of like, do I think it's good enough to sit in a car for 8 hours and listen to and not, and, you know, sit in the driveway and not get out. I don't know. I'm very proud of it.
I almost mean more like when I write an article, all I see are the warts. Like the thing comes out and people will be like, oh, I loved your so-and-so. And I'm like, yeah, but that paragraph there and that word there and the little things that nobody else would ever think of. And I wonder when you create something this in depth, this time consuming, if you're able to just kick back and be like, yeah, I just nailed this. This is great.
I will say that, you know, as somebody who has written a lot of articles in my life, I feel that more with articles I've written than with this podcast, just because of the nature of the production process, because you write a script, you turn it into a producer or two, they give you some notes, then you get it back. And then all of a sudden I find myself reworking entire sections, not because of any notes that they gave, but because a different way that I want to approach it. And then you sit down and you do a table read. And in the table read, like naturally things are going to change. And then you send it off, you get a scratch mix back with none of the music and you hear changes that you want to make. And there's so many steps in the process. And I will say this, and maybe this is the best way to sum it up. The very last monologue-ish thing that I give in the final episode, the final episode came out the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. The weekend after Thanksgiving, myself and one of my producers were kind of in the studio all weekend trying to nail like this seven minute section at the end. And I've worked with many great editors in my life. I've done a lot of writing. It's like, I've never kind of felt that process with writing an article. Like, I'm just going to sit there for 48 hours with one person and work on like 800 words. I think because of the stakes of the storytelling, like not the stakes of the story, but like for what the story meant for me and the amount of investment that I had in it, it was, we have to get everything as right as we can in that, because you only get one shot to do it. It's not like I can like take it down, put it out, right? Put it back out. With key things like that, we really spent a lot of time. There's one moment in the sixth episode, which I'm assuming a lot of your listeners haven't already heard it, but if they have, when I go and confront the wedding scammer, that section where I actually confront him was something that we worked on so much. And it was like, how do we get this right? How do we make sure that everything lands, that we're doing everything? It's like a very crucial moment, both for the story and also for legal reasons, because you have to give the guy a chance to respond to everything he said. Like, are we including the right things? Are we presenting this all well? It was just such a level of review and such a level of thought that honestly, I hadn't experienced with any other project that I've ever done.
I just want to say, and I mean this like literally, episode six, when you confront the scammer, and we'll get into this a little, my hands were sweaty. My hands were actually sweaty with anticipation and nervousness for you. And to me, if you can actually elicit a visceral response from someone listening to your show, that's kind of next level stuff right there. For real. I mean, that's next level.
Thank you. I could tell you that confrontation. So for a little bit of context, we could talk about any details you want to after, but just for a little bit of context for anybody who's listening completely cold, the story basically involves starting with someone who kind of low level scammed me. And then I kind of passively tracked him for years until it got to the point where I could actively track him and try to figure out who the guy is. And track him sounds like I'm like trying to go like Dirty Harry on him, but no, it was just like trying to get some answers to some questions. That moment was a moment that I had been, that moment where I was able to finally confront him, where he's living under yet another different name, was in the moment. So it's actually really funny. I think if when I listened to the recording of that night, there's a moment where the tone of my voice kind of changes, because that's when the nervousness finally kicks in for me. I can hear it. I don't know if anybody else can, but there's a moment where I sit down across from the guy. I'm spoiling some of my podcast if anybody's going to pick it up after.
Yeah.
It's fine. But it's fine. I sit down across from the guy and he says, "Can I help you?" And I said, and I looked at him, and I have a little bit of a Rhode Island accent. I live in LA now, but I'm originally from Providence. And I do think that sometimes this New England accent comes in very handy when you're able to just kind of like instinctually turn it on, because, you know, like all of a sudden you start talking like, hey, you know, like, you know what the accent sounds like. But the guy looks at me and says, "Can I help you?" And I look back at him and I said, "You tell me." And his face went white, but in my voice, like, you could not see his face, but his face went white. But when I hear my voice, I hear like that is the moment where the nerves fully kicked in for me. And I wanted to convey that through the episode. And I think we did. It's probably the craziest thing I've ever done. And I, you know, I'm happy that I came across on some level.
Wait, so I've talked about this on this podcast. I have knocked on many, many doors in the course of my career. And it's terrifying. It's always terrifying. I don't care how old you are. I felt like you really captured the terror. So I am actually interested. Like, you're leading up to this moment. Much of the podcast leads up to this moment where you confront this scammer. You go to Texas. You confront him. He doesn't know you're coming. He doesn't know who you are. You're planning for it. You have a wire attached to you. You've been working on it. You rehearse what you're going to say. In that moment, is the terror just the awkwardness of it? Is the terror that you're working on a show and it has to go right? Like, what is that fear?
So You know, it's a couple episodes earlier, I did a version of that with his dad, and I couldn't play that tape because his dad didn't consent to having the recording. It didn't consent to have it being recorded, so we couldn't record. We had to shut the recorder off. But you know, I relay some of that conversation in the podcast the best I could. Mm-hmm. But I liken that to get to your. Before I get to your question, I just want to back up and talk about this one, because I likened the experience of knocking on his parents' door and end up talking to his dad to my days working at community newspapers and being, it's like the kid died in Iraq. You have to go knock on the parents' door and get a quote from him, like working at like a daily newspaper with 3,000 subscribers. And I have to go do this. And it was the worst. It was the most gut-wrenching thing ever. Like, I have to go talk to these people about the worst thing that's ever happened to them right now. Like, the kid dies in the car crash. I have to go, you know, you go to the scene as a local reporter and you ask those questions. That's kind of how I felt in a weird way about talking to his parents about, hey, I'm looking into your son, the scammer. I assume you know he's a scammer. Let's talk about him. The confrontation with him, with the scammer himself, I was worried about getting everything right. I was worried about like getting my details right. I was worried about something happening, which I think actually did happen, which is because of the way the story came together, I felt like I didn't know the insides and outs of every single piece of evidence against him like I did by the time, you know, I got to writing. And this was, and because of that, I think he was able to kind of honestly, I hate to use a term that gets thrown around a lot these days, but I felt a little gaslit. I felt like he gaslighted me a little. And, you know, scammers are naturally very charming. They are, even if this guy doesn't seem like he's very charming, he still does have some charisma. He's obviously like very, very quick tongued. He just knows how to spin a phrase or tell a lie and just see where it takes him. And he has all the confidence in the world to do that. And he was able to do that a little with me. That was what I was nervous about. And that's what I was nervous about the listener getting frustrated with. And ultimately, I think that the fact that I was able to do this and the fact that I was able to get the things out of him that I did kind of superseded all that. But like the nervousness was, so, okay, it was on one level, am I going to get everything I need to make this show work, to make it feel like the people who have shared their stories with me about getting scammed by this guy, to make it feel like I'm telling their story or getting some type of, not justice, but some type of, you know, payback for them. And the other thing is I'm dealing with a criminal. I'm dealing with a guy who had a criminal record. This is a man who spent time in Rikers. He's doesn't have any violent criminal convictions in his past. I also didn't know the guy well. So there is an element of, you know, you show up at this guy's doorstep. You don't know how he's going to react.
Yeah, I totally get that. That's really interesting. I mean, that's the thing. You never know what's on the other side of the door. I once, I did a story years ago about a former basketball player, Bryce DeJean Jones of the New Orleans Pelicans, mm-hmm. died when someone shot him accidentally through a door. And I knocked on the guy's door and I kept thinking, this guy literally killed someone shooting through a door. There is something right about approaching people. It's rough.
It's different, right? Like it's not like, yeah, it's not like waiting outside the politician's office. It's like you don't know what this person is necessarily capable of. And in my case, I'm lucky that he seemed more scared of who might be showing up to talk to him than, like, I mean, of course, this is the thing, like you corner an animal, you don't know how they're going to react. And that's the thing. But I think that this is the kind of guy who has scammed many people, or has left, at the very least, the lawyers would like me to phrase it, has left a lot of people saying that he owes them a lot of money, and that he's been very dishonest in his dealings with them.
Yeah.
I think he's more worried about who's going to show up and what they're going to do to him.
Right.
And I was never going to do that. I'm a journalist, even if this is a story that I had a personal connection to. I'm still a journalist, and I still had to behave like one. And I honestly never thought of behaving in any other way. Like, it was personal. It was there are certain elements of the story that have upset me, even if not on behalf of me, for other people. I've found myself more upset for other people than for me. At the end of the day, this guy, he didn't take any money from me. He took work from me and then just didn't pay me. You know, I think he owes me like $3,500. And like, that's not crime of the century money. That's not enough to like actually truly upset me. Like back then, like I could have used the $3,500. Don't get me wrong. But I'm not going to show up on someone's doorstep to do this. It was all this accumulation of all this thing these guys had done. And I found myself more upset for what he had done to other people than my interactions with him.
For people who may not know, or if you haven't listened to podcasts, basically, 2016, Justin comes to Los Angeles from Rhode Island. He gets a job at Newsarati, which
Newsarati is the name of it.
Newsarati.
What do you think of the name?
I don't hate it as much as you did. I think it's ridiculous, but it's not like Titty Journal. I mean, it's not like, you know, it could be worse. But he gets a job at Newsarati. It's his new upstart, and there's this wealthy owner, Michael Esposito, and he's all full of swagger and piss and vinegar, and we're going to be the new HuffPost and blah, blah, blah. And it turns out it's all just a scam. No one gets paid. It's all just a big fuckery. And I wonder, like, looking back, do you feel like when you got hired at Newsarati,
hired, quotation marks.
Hired, right. You were deliberately not seeing things because you were so happy to have a gig?
Something didn't feel right about the guy. So I remember, I'll put it this way. The funny thing is I work at The Ringer, this seems like a detail that I'm making up, but I originally started The Ringer as a copy editor. And that was right when The Ringer was launching back in 2016. I started on day one of the website. I had to submit my resume. I wasn't recruited for The Ringer. I submitted my resume as a copy editor. And I legitimately submitted my resume the same day that I got the call from the recruiter for Newsarati, which sounds ridiculous that they had recruiters, but they found me on LinkedIn. And I remember getting out of this very strange interview that I had that Michael Esposito, quote unquote, burst into. And I called my father and he said, how'd it go? And it's like, well, he offered me a pretty decent salary. He's like, are you gonna take it? And I'm like, I guess, but I'm going to tell you this, if The Ringer calls me and offers me half as much, I would take that in a heartbeat. And he goes, my dad, who's not in media, he could not wrap his head around it. Like, one, I'm very happy to work at The Ringer. I'm very happy to work with people like Bill Simmons and Mallory Rubin and what have you. Right. But, I would have and did leap at that opportunity. But but on some level, it was like, something's not right about Newsarati. Something's not right about Michael Esposito. And like, I just kind of knew it deep down. But this is the thing. And this is a thing that I try to get across in that first episode and like at various points throughout the podcast. When you are a person who is in need, and I needed a job, I needed money. Or if you are a person who has dreams that can be exploited, like you're getting married and you want to have a dream wedding or you want to start your dream company. If you have something that can be exploited by scammers, even if deep down you know something's wrong, you're still willing to look past it a little. Like in my gut, I knew that nothing about Michael Esposito felt right. Mm-hmm. I had never met a person who was as rich as he was claiming to be at that point in my life. Sure, maybe they can just act as bizarre as this guy acted. That seems to make sense. We all hear stories about eccentric billionaires. Great. But it was just odd the way that just something didn't smell right. But I was completely willing to look past it. I don't know.
It's kind of, isn't that in a sense what scammers rely on? Is that this deal is so good, but it's not ludicrously good. It's just good enough that you're going to be.
Yes.
Oh, new car. And it's only $4,000. Well, that's a sizable amount of money, but it's not a crazy amount of money. That sounds pretty good.
I mean, I imagine that's why a lot of scams happen on Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace. You know what I mean? It's like we hear about Bernie Madoff and Elizabeth Holmes, but, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried, all these people very famous who go to jail for getting millions of dollars from investors or customers or whatever it is. Most scams are not that. Most scams are, you know, I went to go buy. I remember there was this big story, big story, quote unquote, but it was this big Twitter thread that was going around a couple years ago about this woman who got scammed on, I think it was Facebook Marketplace, for trying to buy vintage Pyrex. And it went viral because like she also confronted the scammer. But that is what most scamming is. It's low level. It's not the it's not this big elaborate conspiracy theory. Like I think that's actually more uncommon. I think in fact, like in my researching of scams to make this podcast, most of the high level day-to-day scam that I heard about, like high level meaning just getting a lot of money from people, romance scams. That seemed to be the most common. It's just, you know, you meet someone and, you know, or sometimes it is you don't even meet them in the flesh. You just develop like an online relationship with them. And all of a sudden you're giving them $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. And it's also an extension of what we're talking about with like having a dream job or, you know, wanting this specific thing that the scammer needs you to buy into. With the romance scam, it's just, this person is either like lonely or this is the love they've been waiting for or whatever it is. And it's just the same idea, just in a different context.
Right. So when do you, you have this thing happen, it's distant past, you didn't lose a shitload of money. You wind up getting this sweet job at a really good place. You're happy. Everything's going well. You're living in LA. Life is great. When are you like, what inspires you or ticks you to go like, you know what? This is something I should go back on, and this is a podcast I should consider doing. How does that actually manifest?
So there were Facebook groups set up after the Newsarati debacle, and with just various people would post things. So it was like, oh, is this Michael Esposito? Is Michael Esposito even his real name? And there would be discussions, and they died down after a while, but they were pretty active in like the year or so afterward. Because it was like, I should say, for anybody who hasn't listened, there were well over 150 people caught up in Newsarati to some extent. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of discussion, a lot of people were upset, and some people were owed more money, some people were owed tens of thousands of dollars, some people just, you know, a lot of people were journalists who got, and so it's just naturally curious people who were caught up in this. There was a moment in 2017 when I learned that someone who works for a major publication was working on an article about Newsarati, and it never came out. But it was, they were starting to interview people and they were trying to piece the story together. And that was like 2017, 2018. And I remember thinking like, God damn it. Like this is my story to tell, if not mine, someone else who got caught up in this. But like, it's not this person coming in, swooping in from the outside. You know, it's like, we're journalists. It's not like we need someone to tell the story. So at that point, like, I kind of put in the back of my mind, I remember early 2019 talking to one of my bosses here at The Ringer saying, you know, I never told you this weird story about this thing that happened to me, but I've done a little bit of research. It seems like this guy's got caught up in other kinds of scams. I would like to turn into maybe an article, like first person essay slash like reporting, trying to figure out what happened here. And they were on board. And then that was 2019. That never comes to fruition. Pandemic hits. I work at a sports and pop culture company. You know what the two things that weren't happening in 2020 were? Sports and pop culture.
Right.
So I'm sitting there and I'm just like thinking of ideas. And it was kind of in the middle of the documentary boom. And this all might sound a little callous, like that, like I'm looking around and I'm seeing like, you know, all these documentaries about scammers and I'm like, I need to do my own. And it wasn't like it wasn't like that. It was just kind of like, I know that the story would work in that context. And I didn't even know half of what I ended up learning. So it was 2020, 2021, where I started making phone calls for real and seeing if there was something. And I realized the story went much deeper. And I learned his real name like fairly early on in my reporting process. And it was most of 2021 that I laid the groundwork for this, but I had to put it on hold because I didn't have an ending. I didn't know where the guy was. I didn't know what name he was using. And, you know, as much as it's great that my bosses gave me the leeway to work on this, kind of in my spare time a little bit on top of what I was doing normally, but they at least gave me their blessing to like, yeah, go see if there's something there. This could turn into something. I had to put it on hold at the end of 2021 because I hit dead ends. I didn't have anyone else to call. People weren't calling me back. I was getting, you know, people that I thought I was going to be able to interview, I wasn't able to speak to. I had an idea that the guy was living in Texas, but I had no proof. That was just kind of based on some things that I heard and some like, I was able to track his boyfriend a little bit, but I didn't know where they were. I didn't know what names they were using. So it wasn't until this, I got a tip in late 2022, which ends up being the focal point of episode 5. That kind of kicks it all into high gear. And then, God, it's tough. It's crazy to think that it was 13 months ago, but 13 months ago is when I went to Texas. And then, you know, this is all a long way of getting at like 2017, 2018, the seed was planted in my head that there was something there. 2020, I really sit down and I have time in the pandemic and I kind of start thinking this is the thing. And then 2021 and 2022, I lay the groundwork for what ends up happening.
It's interesting because you, it seems like with a podcast, it's very easy for the thing to just get fucked up and not work out. Like you don't find Carl or he doesn't talk or a million different reasons that it doesn't work out. So as you're working on it, do you even have confidence that this will work out? Or is it more like, I hope this works out?
I did not have confidence that this thing would work out until we hit publish on episode 1.
Wow.
I thought that like something was going to happen at the 11th hour. And I thought like a lawyer was going to swoop in and be like, no, you can't do this. Or I thought like one of my biggest worries was as it got closer to production and I was trying to get in touch with Carl and now he's, and this is the, you know, and I'm spoiling the name reveal, but it's fine. But this is the same guy that was Michael Esposito, just for anybody who's listening and might be confused. He used many, many, many different names. But as he gets wind that, like, he knew I was a journalist there. Obviously, he hired me as a journalist, which is the irony. But as he gets wind that, like, oh, this is actually something. This is actually going to be something much more massive than, like, any small news article that's been written about me. As he gets wind of that, my biggest worry was actually that he was going to start paying everyone back and I just wouldn't have a podcast, which I guess I would still have a podcast being like, you know, I got this guy to pay everyone back, which would have been fantastic. But I mean, I still want him to pay everyone back. But I was really worried that he would do something at the last minute that would make it be like, well, he's not really a scammer. You can't really do that. And it's like, but luckily, you know, it's the scorpion and the toad, you know, it's the scorpion's always going to be the scorpion and he's just not going to pay anyone back.
I feel like you really wanted him to be a decent guy. Like I felt like, I don't feel like you were gaslit, but I feel like you really wanted him. Like you kind of always gave this, like, almost like this idea of like, I think there's a chance he might pay people back. There's a chance he might be so-and-so. Maybe he wants to be a good guy and he's just blank. Or am I misreading that a little bit?
No, I think, you know, I do think it's kind of, it can be a storytelling cop out to be like, shrug your shoulders and be like, I don't know, people are complicated. Or like, not everyone's inherently evil, but sometimes people do evil things. I do think that can be a storytelling cop out in some ways, but I think because his scams were so chaotic and because that at times, yes, he got money out of them, but at times it seemed to be about status as much as money, that I found it hard to believe that anybody would sit down and be like, this is my plan for the next 10 years of my life, and this is the way that I'm going to get money. It kind of felt like this is a guy who was just trying to survive and do it the only way he can. And he just also happened to be a very dishonest guy. Right. I tried to have empathy for him. And by the way, a lot of listeners got very angry with me at the end for having empathy for him. Right. And my take on that is you're free to arrive at your own conclusion. If you felt that way, then maybe the reporting did its job in his own right. But I tried to have an understanding because, look, again, he's not Bernie Madoff. He's not Elizabeth Holmes. I had to try to understand who this guy is. And because so much of what he's saying was dishonest, so much of what he told me was dishonest, you have to go to the next level of thinking and try to look into this man's soul and try to figure out what's really going on there. And by the way, I don't want to specify, but there were certain things that he told me in our interviews that I have since found out since the podcast came out that were just completely false, like things about his upbringing that he seemed to make very clear, like, this is part of the thing that made me who I am. I've had people reach out to me and say that it was absolutely 100% not the case. If anything, it was the exact opposite, which is, I tried to leave the room open. I tried to leave a little wiggle room there in case that was the case. You know, I tried to have empathy for him, but at the same time, with the understanding that this is a man who has lied a million times. And like, at what point do you believe the boy who cried wolf?
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey. And what is that on your ankle?
It's a tattoo of a boot.
You got a tattoo of a boot on your ankle? Young lady, you're only 19 years old.
Dad, calm down. It's not just any boot.
I am so angry.
Dad, it's the kicking shoe worn by Garrett Lindholm, kicker for the 2011 Milwaukee Mustangs of the Arena Football League. I wanted to let people know they can go to royalretros.com and buy a hand-stitched, made-with-love Mustangs jersey.
Ugh, did you really have to get a tattoo to do this?
The butt-piercing pavilion was closed.
It's really interesting because it's like, it almost begs, like, all right, as journalists, I always say, like, our job isn't to tell the person that Barry Bonds is an asshole. Our job is to explain how Barry Bonds became an asshole.
Yes.
And in this case, you have this guy, Michael Esposito, a.k.a. Carbucho. And I could see you really trying to not just say, hey, this guy's a scammer, but to say, here's why this guy is so broken. And that seems like a real challenge to be able to do that with a guy who's so broken that he doesn't really know how to tell the truth.
Yeah. It was, I think it was a challenge. I think, you know, I only had so much information to go off because one of the things that's amazing about this guy is somehow in the 21st century, there's so little available on him online. And part of that was because he went to prison and kind of disappeared after. I keep on saying prison. The lawyers would want me to get this right. He went to jail. Rikers is a jail.
Yeah.
But after he went to jail for the final time, he's kind of disappeared as an official person. If you Google his name right now, all that pops up is really wedding scammer stuff and then some information about his dad who he shares a name with. There's really just not that much to go off. It was hard to track down. He grew up in a very small town. I don't think he grew up with many friends. I think he grew up kind of bullied. I think this was probably actually had more to do with anything than what he told me in the podcast, but I think he grew up kind of bullied a little. This is information that's been relayed to me. And I think that helped form who he was. He got good at being someone who, he got good at learning to be someone else. And he took on this facade is kind of how I see it. Now, maybe I'm psychoanalyzing here. And one thing I wanted to avoid was trying to understand this person without turning to armchair psychology, because one thing I vowed never to do in this podcast was bring on a psychologist or someone who had never met him to try to explain to me who he was. There was one point where I turned to another story from another podcaster and spoke to that podcaster to look for similarities. Mm-hmm. But I tried to avoid doing that with Carl myself, because the reality is you can only know this guy so much. And it's tough to say unless I'm actually had a psychiatrist unless you had someone who had worked with him directly, it's impossible to say what's actually going on in there.
Yeah. I'm about to start writing a book where I've interviewed whatever hundreds of people, and it's always like, fuck, how am I going to do this every time? Fuck, how am I going to do this? And you go on this journey and this adventure, and you interview dozens and dozens of people, and you travel around, and you have this track down. When it's finally time to really piece it together and put it together, it seems extremely hard to organize something that's so winding and unruly. Was it, or am I overthinking this?
You know what's funny? So in 2021, when I was first telling my bosses this can be a real thing, I sat down and I wrote an episode outline, and I went back and looked at it. And this was, I didn't know where he was. I didn't know half of it, right? The first four episodes look identical to that outline that I wrote in 2021 before I knew where the story was actually finally headed. Wow. And then even like 5, 6, and 7 have the contours of what I imagined in there. So honestly, I kind of always knew how I wanted to tell the story. However, taking all those interviews and turning it into something, it was the most daunting thing I've ever done, man. I had that confrontation with him in late January 2023. I don't think I was capable of sitting down and starting to write until probably about a year ago this month, to like actually sit down and start writing scripts. It was probably mid-March. And some of that's like I had other projects I had to finish up because, you know, I wish this was the only thing I was doing last year, but I had other things I had to do. But it was, I don't know how I'm going to do this. It felt like, you know, the only way to walk up a mountain is one step at a time. But it's just taking that first step can seem so daunting.
Yeah.
And I don't know. But I will say that when you go through transcriptions, when you listen to other interviews, sometimes things click for you that you don't even realize in the moment. So there's a thing I do in episode 4, and I'd like to spoil this. I'd like to not spoil this because this is one of my favorite thing I do in the entire podcast. I don't know how other people feel that I've listened to it, but it's my favorite thing I do in the entire podcast besides the confrontation. But I received all these recordings of the guy, like all these recordings that people have taken illegally over the years. And I use some of them throughout the podcast. And, you know, some of them are like just to demonstrate the way that this guy lies. But one of them was, yes, he was lying, but I kind of played it too because I wanted to get in his mind. This is the beginning of episode 4. I wanted to give a little bit of his mindset, and I wanted to show a little bit more of who he was. And he says this one thing that ends up connecting to this big idea that someone else says to me. And I had no idea until I was sitting down to piece that episode together in July. So months and months and months after I had first heard that tape, or after I'd done this interview with this person. And when I heard both of those things, and that's just simply me looking at the transcripts, I was like, huh. So even with knowing how I'm gonna piece this all together, even with knowing how I'm gonna tell the story, it's gonna start here, it's gonna end up here. This episode is gonna be the episode where I confront him. This is the episode where I'm gonna go see his parents. Like, knowing all that stuff, it's still not till you actually sit down and look at everything in front of you that all the pieces start to click into place.
Right. Yeah.
It's crazy. It's a crazy thing we do, Jeff, to talk to all these hundreds of people and then try to tell a coherent story, and just knowing that like half of them are going to be like, well, you didn't tell everything I said. And it's like, well, yeah, but like, I can't say every single word. I don't know.
Did you interview people who did not make the final cut?
Many.
And did you get the requisite? What the fuck, man?
Only one, because I think, because some of these people took a lot of convincing to speak to, because I was talking to them about being scammed. And then like, I think some of them were ultimately a little disappointed because they got to the place where they agreed to speak with me. And then I was ultimately like, hey, look, you tried to tell a streamlined story. I can see where that can be very annoying. But one person who I worked with at Newsarati, she was so upset that I didn't include her. She I gave her a heads up because I knew she was going to be upset because we were. So I think this is very funny because it was a fake job, but I managed her, but we ended up becoming kind of close effort. It's very funny. Like I was her manager at this fake company for a month and we ended up becoming kind of close and we were friends for a little bit and then we drifted apart over time, but we reconnected in 2021 and we did a couple interviews. It just didn't really move the story along. And also she said a bunch of stuff that the lawyers were like, you can't, no. It was just like, okay, like, I don't need more voices in here, so I'm going to cut her out. So about 2 weeks before the podcast, the first episode went live, I gave her a call. And she was the only person that I felt the need to call in advance and be like, I'm just sorry. I'm not including you. She was so upset. I feel bad. And this is actually what's really funny, and I think this actually gets at a really interesting idea in journalism, where she said... Maybe in journalism as a whole, but it got into an interesting idea for me. And it kind of ties into when I was talking about this other reporter from the larger publication trying to swoop in and tell the story. She said to me, I've been telling people the News of Roddy story for years. And now that you're telling it without me, it feels like it's not even my story. Like this didn't even happen to me. And that really kind of resonated with me in a way that like,
that's pretty well said, actually. Yeah,
I might be like dressing up a little, but
I get it. The sentiment is real. I get that,
and I really felt that, and I did feel for that in that moment. And I was like, you know, I gave her an extended thank you on the final episode because I did really feel that. Maybe some of that's a little bit of guilt, but also what she said is true. Like this is a thing that happened to many people had interactions with this guy, and I just happened to be the one telling the story. And, you know, we make choices in our storytelling when we're telling these kind of sprawling stories. We choose who we're going to include. We choose what kind of quotes we're going to use. We choose, like, the narrative that, as it makes sense to us. And in this case, the narrative just didn't work with her story. And I do feel a little bit of guilt about that.
So did you hear from her after the series wrapped? Or have you ever heard from her?
Yeah, she listened to the whole thing. And I'm very appreciative that she stuck with it because I think at the end of the day, this was a very bizarre thing that happened to her as well. And she wanted to see how it all played out. It was very funny. People like her and other people who were involved in this, like were scammed by him, ended up listening kind of like listeners too. It's very funny. Like I would have random people who got scammed by him in San Francisco that would hit me up and be like, oh, this person you spoke to in Texas is like, they're kind of dumb, huh? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? Like, they're listening like listeners. It's just like, it's very deeply funny that when this becomes not just a real life story, when it becomes this, now we're telling this in this kind of serialized narrative podcast format, it ends up taking on this different shape to even where people who were listening to the show, I mean, people who were involved are now listening like an audience member. And I guess it kind of gives like an uncanny valley feel to your own life a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know, like the aftermath of the aftermath. Has Carl just vanished again? Is he still running his wedding business? Did he pay more people back or is he just ghost?
The business is still intact. I've spoken to a lot of couples who have reached out to me for advice. As they've heard the podcast, like I can only imagine how they feel hearing the podcast, knowing that they have a wedding booked with this guy who's the subject of a podcast named The Wedding Scammer. Yeah. Like that feels like a nightmare. Like of everything you think of that can go wrong with the wedding, you don't think a true crime podcast is going to be involved.
It's true.
But you know, my advice with them is like, if you feel comfortable, just go along with it because if he's going to provide a level of service and you feel comfortable with that level of service, you got to go along with it. I always tell them come up with a contingency plan. I have not heard from Carl. Carl has me blocked on every single possible mode of communication. I am blocked on Instagram. I am blocked on Facebook. I am blocked. My phone number is blocked. I would assume my email is blocked. I am just blocked across the board. So I have not heard from him. I've heard from people who have had some run-ins with him. He's saying some things about me that very much aren't true. And I'm saving those in case we ever do a bonus episode. I will tell you off air. But I'm saving it. There's one thing that he says that I really hope to put out into the world one day.
Oh.
But I cannot wait till I can do that. But, you know, it has to rise to the level of something. There's a justifiable reason for us to do a bonus episode. I've heard from people who have been involved, who were taken in other scams by him. Or they tell me that, I should specify, because I haven't done the full reporting there to vet that. You know, I've heard stories, but it was people with very similar stories to everyone else that kind of predates even Newsarati. I have, for a brief while, so there's a kind of a secondary bad guy whose name is Lawrence Tonner that pops up in episode 3. He was calling me and texting me a lot. He became my buddy for a little bit. I haven't heard from him in a little bit. He wished me a happy Thanksgiving and a happy, you know, Merry Christmas, which was just always before even I think my mother did. Interesting life I've created for myself, where the secondary bad guy in my true crime podcast is, you know, wishing me a happy Thanksgiving. But that's the life I created by jumping into this world. But I think even he developed kind of a parasocial relationship with this story, even though he was involved too. It's like just the strange thing about the podcast format, where you live in someone's ears for 7 hours, 8 hours, whatever it is, or like, you know, a weekly podcast, even if it's somebody listening to you every week on this, they develop this relationship with you. And it's so much different than anything I've ever done when it comes to writing or anything like that. It's just a different kind of relationship.
Yeah. I think you get that from books a little bit too, where all of a sudden you have this weird collection of quirky friends that you never would have, and associates and people. Why is this rapper texting me happy Thanksgiving? You know, I didn't see that coming in life. It's kind of one of the fun parts of this biz, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I love it. You know, it's, I cannot imagine doing anything else. This was a story that I've been trying to tell for a while, and it ended up becoming one of the most creatively rewarding things I've ever done. It became a like very personally rewarding thing. I hope that all the people who participated feel like they got something out of it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I made it for listeners. So I hope that there are more listeners who, when they have to make their drives from Oakland to Orange County, want to sit in the car and not stop until it's finished.
Yeah, I think you'll get that. Let me ask you, I feel like years ago when Serial, the first Serial came out, it was like, oh man, all right, here we are. We have found the new future of long form storytelling, and it is podcasts.
Yes.
And I remember the host was on like the Tonight Show, whatever, you know, Tonight Show, and it blew up.
Yeah,
right. And then there are more podcasts and big podcasts. And I did a podcast, a true crime podcast. Audible paid me $100,000 to do it.
Wow. Like, wow.
I was like, this is amazing. You know, this is great. This is the future. This is it. We found a medium that can work. It's moved past print. And it doesn't feel like that has really happened. It feels like there are a shitload of podcasts. Most of them don't land. You work for a company. Spotify owns The Ringer. You guys are, you know, The Ringer is very well known for its podcast. How do you, as a guy coming off of a very successful podcast, see the role of podcasts in storytelling in modern media?
So it's funny. So I work on another... there are a lot of interesting things you said in there, Jeff. But I work as a producer on several other shows. And one of them is called 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. It's hosted by Rob Harvilla. We kind of conceptualize that together, but Rob is the engine that makes that go. Because he's just so good at what he does. But that's like kind of, it's like, you know, we use it when we talk about these kinds of long form storytelling podcasts, we use the word narrative podcast. That's like half narrative, where Rob's writing these scripts every week, but he's also doing some analysis. And like, I do think there's a format for that. It's like when you look on YouTube and the most popular videos are like, you know, breakdown of Oppenheimer. You know, that's right. Like the most popular movie YouTubes. And I do think there's more room for stuff like that in podcasting. We have the podcast Dissect at The Ringer. We kind of inherited that from Spotify. So I work on that in some capacity. And Cole Kushner has done a great job with kind of doing this narrative storytelling when it comes to specific albums. The reality is, though, types of shows like The Wedding Scam or types of shows like Serial, they're very expensive to make. I mean, you just told me about Audible, you know, like these shows are very expensive to make, and it's tough. This is the kind of podcasting that I really got hooked on, right? I had been listening to some podcasts before Serial came up, and then Serial comes along. Then, you know, like, of course, there are podcasts like S-Town, but Chameleon was a podcast that I ended up really latching onto, partially because I was telling a similar story at the time it was coming out. There have just been so many good narrative podcasts that I've been into, and it does feel like they're in danger to a little bit, because it's so much more to produce something like The Wedding Scammer than it is to two guys turn on mics and talk about the NBA. And the thing is, two guys can turn on mic and talk about the NBA from now until the end of time, and the advertisers know exactly what they're getting, yada, yada. With The Wedding Scammer, you get 7 episodes, and then it's done. And then you hope that it finds another life like it has. Like, it's steadily had listeners come into it since it wrapped up right after Thanksgiving. You know, you found it a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. The hope is it can do that forever, and that justifies it. But it's like, it's tough, man. And there's so much out there.
Well, it's a little bit like, I had a book become a TV show, Winning Time on HBO, right? It's great. Great. Good numbers, blah, blah, blah. But like, it's really expensive to make. And Love is Blind, which costs them almost nothing, is going to get more viewers. So what's the motivation for companies to spend money when they can put out shit like Love is Blind?
I think we're in a really tricky time, right, where we look around our industry and there have been mass layoffs and companies shutting down and everything. And I don't think this means it's the end for digital media. And this isn't to say I know exactly what comes next, but we're in a little bit of a time of readjustment time. And I don't think this is the end. But we does feel like we're at a time where companies are only want to mainly invest in the things that they know can make money. And I get worried about that, because I've never seen Love is Blind. I'm not going to watch Love is Blind, but I loved Winning Time, you know? Like, it's, I worry about, I guess, art, about journalism. I worry about all these things that matter, because it's just become, it's the easiest thing for companies to invest in the cheapest thing, especially if that's getting the most viewers. I always kind of looked at it like, you know, sometimes the cheap and easy stuff that makes a lot of money has to fund the better stuff you do, because that's just the way it works. And I think when you, I don't know, we can have a whole discussion about how private equity has, you know, I think saying private equity is affecting media right now is kind of like, it's a trend that people keep coming back to in our sphere. But we're dealing with a lot of people in media companies and entertainment companies that didn't rise up because they're creatives, because they really care about this stuff. We're talking about people coming with MBAs or coming from other industries, and they only look at the bottom line. And that really worries me, because it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't make a show, like if you don't take a chance on a show like The Wedding Scammer, then you're never going to have a Wedding Scammer. And like, you don't know if it's going to be a success. I don't know. Is that depressing, Jeff?
It's 100%. Wait, it's really interesting, because you had me thinking when you were saying that, how back in the day, I referenced Sports Illustrated way too much in this podcast, but like when I was at Sports Illustrated, truly, it felt like we can do this, so we can do this. If we do this, we'll be able to do this. And it does feel more and more like now it's like someone's going to be like a show like The Wedding Scammer. It used to be, we can do this and this and this, so we can do shows like The Wedding Scammer. And nowadays you have a lot of people who are not creatives who are saying, well, why would we even do The Wedding Scammer? Because we can make more money not doing The Wedding Scammer. So why would we do that? And quality just dies.
And I think this is, you know, this is not like the Suge Knight come to death row speech, right? But this is where I say that working for a company started by people like Bill Simmons and Sean Fennessy and Mallory Rubin is great because these people came up as creatives. Like, you know, they even still are creatives. They were writers and editors. They're mostly podcasters now. But they are people who get it. And I feel very fortunate to be there, to be where I'm at the Ringer with people in charge who understand this, instead of being at another company that might not get this, that might have pushed out the creatives who were making the place run and are just now you're turning to five guys named Josh with MBAs who are taking meetings as they on AirPods as they walk through airport terminals and they're making decisions on people's lives. And it just, it all starts to feel very gross. And at the Ringer, it's not like that. And it's great.
Yeah. Well, I gotta say, I was writing for Bleacher Report alongside a young scrappy upstart named Miran Fader. And we were both doing these long stories for Bleacher Report, and they would send you out and they'd spend money and 8,000 words on some athlete. And at some point Bleacher Report decided it's not really worth it. We can spend no money and put up a bunch of videos of a monkey shooting basketballs or a duck, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we'll get the same number of viewers. And it actually warms my heart to see Miran writing for the Ringer and the Ringer still pumping out high quality stuff. So
Miran is great. I was literally, you know, we also, speaking of Bleacher Report alum, we also, Howard Beck is here now.
Yeah, he's great.
He's the best. He's the absolute best. I'm honored to work at a place that Howard Beck also works at. It was, I hope I'm not blowing up Howard's spot, but he was hired like in the middle of me working on The Wedding Scammer. And then he reached out to me to tell me he was a fan of The Wedding Scammer. And I was like, this is just crazy. Like, Howard Beck should not be telling me he's a fan of me. Like, this is crazy. Like, it's kind of the same thing when I get it, when I get a message from you. Like, it's, I'm
you're just saying we're older than you. We're just saying you're older. You're just making,
all right, fine. But, you know, but I got on the phone with, like, it's just, I got on the phone with Howard and we talked for like 2 hours one day a couple months ago. And it's just like, this is just amazing that I get to work at a place that not only is run by creatives, but also creatives who are like, hey, Howard Beck's out there. Let's hire Howard Beck.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Great. I'm with you 100%. Howard's one of the best. I usually ask as a final question something about the worst confrontation you've had as a journalist. But I'm going to. We kind of covered that. Okay. You have how many tattoos, would you say?
Oh, God. I haven't counted in a while. I think it's probably, it's over 30.
What's the story of your most painful tattoo?
Well, I mean, the most painful one is probably not that interesting. It's the most painful is just, I thought I was going to puke when we were filling in this elbow, which is just some bullshit here. It's just like, it's just to fill in that spot. The most painful was probably, honestly, I have a giant tattoo on my leg and it was only painful because this was, you know, I'm sober now, but I was not at the time. And I was very, very hungover. And so was my friend who was doing the tattoo. And I like, there is nothing more to that story than it was just, you know, two people who should not have been operating any type of machinery that would leave a permanent mark on another human being. And it was just, and also the best part was, it's a pretty big tattoo. And it's kind of the thing where I would typically get done over the course of a couple sessions, but he insisted on trying to get it done all in one day. And he didn't tell me that he had booked someone for it to come in, like basically right after me. So we had to be done. And to this day, like I look at this, I'm wearing shorts and I'm looking at it right now. It's very jagged in a few spots that he was doing at the very end. It's like this tattoo that started off very beautiful. And then it's just like, oh, he was just trying to like get me done so he can get that person in to like tattoo a butterfly at the last minute.
That's awesome. I have tattoo aspirations, but I don't have tattoo courage and I have no tattoos.
So. You know, it's the thing is if when I went to go get my first tattoo, I was nervous. I was like,
how old were you?
I was like 19. Yeah. And the artist said to me, if it was that painful, no one would get it. No, that's not to say like it still sucks, but like, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people walking around with it. If it's that painful, because people wouldn't do it. So, and then the other form of the courage is you worry about just committing to something for that long. at a certain point, you know, it's, I think I saw a tweet yesterday that somebody's like, my first tattoo, like, I'm going to get, like, this means something to me because this was, like, you know, something my grandmother used to do and this speaks to what I, blah, blah, blah. 30th tattoo. I'm going to get a paperclip because I think that looks really cool. Like, I'm showing you, I can't think you, yeah. You can't see, it's hard to do it, but it's just like, I have like wind up cheddar box teeth on my wrist. And it's like, why did I do that? I'm like, I don't know. I just woke up one day and thought that would be funny to put there. Like at a certain point, it's just like, I like that idea of that tattoo.
So I'm just going to leave it to you, Justin. I was thinking because I'm working on Tupac that I'm going to get the big Tupac cross with Thug Life across my entire back. What do you think? Yeah.
I'm going to co-sign that, Jeff. See, behind every tattoo, there's a story of someone who didn't talk them out of it. So I will be that person for you.
Thank you. My wife will be calling you after I come home with the Thug Life tattoo.
That will actually be the most awkward confrontation I've had as a journalist.
That's awesome. Wait, sincerely, Justin, you did a great, I know you know this, but you did a tremendous, tremendous job of storytelling and writing and piecing it together. It's just a great, it's one of my favorite podcasts I've ever listened to. I thought it was just beautiful and awesome. So bravo. And thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much, Jeff. And thank you for having me on. And thank you for the kind words. And thank you for everything.
I want to thank today's guest, Justin Sales, for joining me on Two Riders Slinging Yang. You can follow Justin on Twitter at Docs Ellis. Read his work at theringer.com and listen to The Wedding Scammer wherever podcasts are available. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing Yang, please go to a vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the Smokin' MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.